Our next speaker is Connor. He's going to talk about reflective scalar fields in numerical relativity. Please, Connor, what is yours?
Hi, everyone. My name is Connor Daly. I'm a PhD student here at resident at the Perimeter Institute in conjunction with the University of Waterloo. And the past year or so, I've been working on a project on sort of implementing the full initial boundary value problem in general relativity. And it's been quite a road moving along on this project. And there's lots of interesting details I'd like to share with you. So just to give you a short motivation on why this is kind of interesting. So when people normally think about numerical relativity, or when physicists try to implement numerical relativity, they try not to deal with boundaries in their problems, because boundaries are really messy to deal with. And so they play numerous tricks to try to move the boundaries really far away, or move the boundaries inside an event horizon, or other associated solutions, so that they don't have to deal with it. But in this particular project, where we're kind of interested in how in black hole echoes, which are this sort of reflecting behavior that you might have near an event horizon, we want to simulate that with having an actual hard boundary in our domain. And so you need to know how to properly deal with boundaries in a numerical relativity problem. And so essentially what I have done is in spherical symmetry, I've put two hard boundaries in an actual evolution problem. I've sort of figured out how to properly deal with these and come up with a stable evolution. The other nice thing is I've implemented this in a sort of modern language. So a lot of numerical relativity codes are using pretty old languages today. This one was all implemented in Julia, which is fairly new on the scene. So just to sort of give a review, where I'm going to talk about how you reflect a scalar field in numerical relativity. We should know how you reflect a scalar field just in the regular wave equation. The nice thing about the wave equation is it essentially looks like you applied two advection operators to your actual scalar field. So you have essentially a right moving mode and a left moving mode. And at the boundaries, what you'll end up doing is you get to choose what to do with any characteristic modes in your system that are propagating into the domain. So if I have a left moving mode that's going to come to the left boundary here, I get to choose what kind of mode I get to exchange it with at the boundary. And so if you think about the Dirichlet type reflection problem, that looks like this, where effectively what I'm doing is I'm exchanging a moving characteristic with a characteristic moving the other direction, but now it has some negative amplitude. And so what it looks like to us is you know, like a sort of mirror boundary hitting here. But the right way to think about it is I'm exchanging characteristics at the boundary. So this is like the classical wave equation. And the important thing to note is that it has simple speeds. The speed to the left is the same as the speed going to the right. But when we start complicating things, and you think about the actual Klein-Gordon equation, now you're mixing it with your metric, and sort of complicated things can happen. So when you start trying to implement this problem numerically, what you like to do is move it into a first order system of equations. So you define something that holds your time derivative of your scalar, and you define another thing, I call it psi here, that contains your spatial derivative. And so you have a system of equations where the first two are just definitions essentially, and then all of the meat of the wave equation just has some complicated right-hand side. And so if you look, the first thing you need to do in order to properly do the initial boundary value problem is you need to identify your characteristic modes. And in this case, there are two characteristic modes, and they have speeds that are not necessarily as simple as we had before. They may be completely different. So in some sense, when you reach a boundary, you're going to have to exchange characteristic modes that are traveling at different speeds. And so it sort of complicates the idea a little bit. So when you identify these characteristic modes, you want to be able to exchange them at the boundary, and to properly do this, you have this sort of, you write down the advection system for your characteristics, and then you translate that back into your original variables. In the case of Dirichlet reflection, this is somewhat simple because two of them happen to be zero, and then the last variable has some thing that ends up depending on the actual speeds. So let's take a look at what that might look like. So in this case, what I've done is I've used a constant background, a Kerr shield black hole background. And you can see the inner boundary one here is at like 3m, another one's at 9m. And so what's going to happen is, nice thing about Kerr shield coordinates is it's sort of designed in such a way that the ingoing speeds are always the speed of light, but then the positive speeds sort of vary as you move along your domain. They're zero at the event horizon, as you might expect, and then it sort of grows. So you're going to have a light speed mode traveling towards the inner boundary, and then you're going to exchange it with a mode that's traveling out that's going to be traveling much slower. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So it turns out that the full Klein-Gordon equation, at least with a constant background, has a conserved energy. So you can see that the pulses essentially are acting in such a way to conserve this energy, where if it's traveling really slow, it sort of squishes in order to conserve energy. And so you have this sort of varying pulse width also. So this is the kind of behavior we would expect in the weak field limit if we're doing the full numerical relativity problem. We have these sort of exchanging of modes and this change of widths going on here. So how do we do this in full numerical relativity? So just like before, when you start adding a varying metric, what you want is a system of variables where the whole thing is first order. And there's tons of different ways that people have proposed over the years of how to do this. Essentially, you have complete freedom with how you define the actual higher order variables that sort of encode the information of your time and spatial derivatives. And so you can choose any sort of definition you like and then write down your evolution equations. But in a lot of examples, the characteristic speeds and modes of the system can be very complicated and can have non-physical speeds. For example, if you have gauge modes in your system, they don't necessarily have to travel less than or equal to the speed of light. So your choice of formalism actually becomes important when you want to be able to deal with the boundaries, because what you would like is well-defined characteristic speeds. It'd be nice if they were physical, but you don't want the characteristics to be too complicated, or else the boundaries conditions will be very complicated also. So the particular formalism that I have chosen is called the Einstein-Christoffel system. And the Einstein-Christoffel system is very nice in the sense that it has very, very simple characteristic speeds and modes. So the way that it's generally approached is you do this sort of natural 3+1 split, where you have a lapse alpha and a shift beta. You also have some three metric variables. So these are the sort of first order variables that you run in your system, and then you define some higher order variables that take care of the information of your time and spatial derivatives that make the system first order. In this case, another common natural choice is the extrinsic curvature, which sort of encodes the time information from the time derivatives. And then doesn't really have a name, but it's this 3 tensor F is what they define in this particular system. Has some complicated definition, but it's sort of designed carefully such that it the characteristics turn out very very nice when you actually write down the evolution equations. So in spherical symmetry, this decomposition, you have a radial part of your eccentric curvature and an angular part, and then same thing for this like three tensor F. So if you write down your full, you know, system of equations, I have six variables for my metric variables, and then I have some gauge variables that I get to essentially do arbitrarily. So that's essentially our system. Now, when you write down the evolution equations, as normal with numerical relativity, the equations are long and ugly and gross. But in this particular formalism, it has a very nice form. Everything on the left-hand side of this system of equations is all of the time and spatial derivatives that exist for your state vector. Everything else with the dots is all just source terms. And so it has this sort of nice form where all of the advection dynamics are taken care of on this left-hand side, and then everything else is sort of these source terms. So if you go ahead and write down the characteristic modes for your system, you write down a matrix for these advection terms, and you find the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and you get this sort of system of characteristics. And if you have any experience with looking at different formalisms, the characteristics of any formalism can look very complicated and have sort of complicated speeds and stuff. But these ones, the dynamics are particularly clear. And the other nice thing about the system is all the characteristics have physical speeds. And so what that means is if you put a boundary on the inside of an event horizon, all of the modes in your system are now outgoing of the domain, so you don't have to apply any boundary conditions there. So the sort of black hole excision problem becomes somewhat trivial. So I'll talk about how I do the actual numerical relativity problem. The first thing is I pick Kerr-Shield coordinates just because it's kind of convenient. But what you need to do is if you put a scalar field in your domain, you have to solve the constraints. And the constraints essentially tell you whether or not you're correctly solving Einstein's equations. And so there's two constraints two sort of Einstein equation derived constraints from numerical relativity or from Einstein's equations that you have to solve at the initial time. If you pick the specific form where you let the mass vary as a function of r, then it turns out that the momentum constraint is trivially solved as long as you have a certain condition on your scalar field at the initial time, which is that its momentum is zero. And then all you have to do is integrate the mass with the energy density, and you have a correct initial problem. So you sort of set this condition, which is the momentum of your scalar field equals to zero at the beginning. And that's essentially what I did with the scalar field problem before, where you just have a pulse just sort of sitting there. So this is how you do the initial data with the constraints. The hard part happens to be how you treat the boundary conditions. So the boundary conditions in a general sort of unconstrained hyperbolic problem, like a system of hyperbolic equations, essentially all of the ingoing modes into your domain, you have free rein over. You can specify anything you like. But in a constrained problem like this, where I have to essentially solve some constraints at every time step, that assures that I'm solving Einstein's equations, you're restricted by the constraints. So one thing that I found some people do, one way to deal with this is, for example, at the left boundary, you happen to have two incoming modes that you get to specify in your domain. What they do is, given an evolution of one of these, they fix it with the constraints. So the constraints completely dictate what's happening to one of these modes. And then the other mode is left completely arbitrary, as long as your boundary is outside the event horizon. And then a similar thing happens at the right boundary, where there are four incoming modes, but three of them are fixed with constraints in your system, and the other one is left arbitrary. And essentially what this will do is it assures that in the continuum limit of your problem, the constraints are satisfied throughout your entire domain, including the boundaries. And so this is one way to approach the boundaries. It may not be a sort of unique way, but in some sense, you have to take the constraints into account when you do this. So here's a result of me sort of applying this. Essentially, this the same sort of initial conditions that I was talking about before. You have a scalar field here around a black hole. I have it specifically from 7 to 11m in this case. And I've scaled it by the radius r so that the amplitude remains the same up here. And so you can see that the initial constraint solver starts, you know, at the black hole mass I've specified as 1 and then integrates it up to some total mass. And so this is what it sort of sits here. This is called the Meissner-Sharp mass, and it sort of encodes the actual mass of your spacetime as a function of r. So at the top, you'll see the scalar field equations at work. And then at the bottom, the Meissner-Sharp mass only depends on metric variables. So this is sort of encodes what's happening with your actual time evolution. So let's take a look at this real quick. So just like before, you'll see this sort of varying width a little bit, not as dramatic as before, since I have it not as close to the black hole. But what's really nice to see is that you essentially see the same sort of reflection that I dictated with my scalar field as you do with your metric variables, this sort of physical Meissner-Sharp mass. And you can see it bouncing back and forth. And so this essentially shows you the interplay between the two things. Another interesting thing to note in this simulation is you might notice that one of them is heavier than the other. And the reason for this, if I just sort of stop it here, is you, wait, let's see at the beginning. As you can see that, like I was telling you before, the ingoing one is traveling at something close to the speed of light, but then the outgoing one has some speed less than that. So although the pulses have the same amplitude when they split apart, one is traveling faster than the other, and so it has a higher mass. And you can sort of see that sort of play around as the pulses move around, as they're sort of, they exchange this sort of differing mass between them. So so this is kind of my first successful try at doing this problem. And I didn't talk too much about the actual numerical implementation because I don't have so much time, but suffice to say that I have implemented this using fourth order finite differencing for spatial derivatives and fourth order Runge-Kutta time integration. So I expect fourth order convergence. And so I've sort of used the Hamiltonian momentum constraints of my system to see how well I'm converging towards Einstein's equation solutions here. And you can see, you know, relatively consistent fourth order convergence throughout the actual time period. So there's lots left to do that I can play around with this. I started the problem far away from the black hole with relatively low amplitude. But what we're kind of interested in with the black hole echoes program is we would like to put the boundary very close to the horizon and see under what conditions that we can actually get a stable evolution of reflecting a scalar wave when the scalar wave itself is modifying in some sense the apparent horizon of the black hole. So can you actually get a reflection before an apparent horizon sort of forms around your scalar field pulse and prevents you from actually applying boundary conditions at your boundary? And there's certain gauge conditions that we can choose that, for example, will keep one of the boundaries fixed relative to the apparent horizon. And so we're going to sort of implement this. Another thing is there's other types of boundary conditions. I picked Dirichlet type reflection just because it's particularly simple to implement. But in principle, you can do all sorts of other stuff like Neumann type reflection or Robin conditions and stuff. And those may impose other conditions, associated conditions on your actual spacetime. I've also used a massless scalar field here so that in classically it travels at the speed of light. But you can do this with any sort of mass and see what sort of things happen in your domain when you add that. And another thing that we're kind of interested in is there is some precedent for imagining a scalar field that might gain an effective mass near an event horizon. And so what we were thinking about is sort of implementing a radius-dependent mass where it sort of gains mass near the event horizon. And similar to how a light pulse might sort of get a reflection or transmission when it goes from vacuum to glass, for example, you would expect the same sort of behavior with a scalar field, where if it sort of gains some mass near the event horizon, you get some transmission, you get some reflection. And so this is kind of like the sort of next steps for some of the evolution paradigms that we're thinking about. And so that's all I have for you. Any questions? Sure.
So you mentioned that the in and out point pulse in your prescription have different propagation speeds. And essentially, that's why you argue that you get the different masses. How covariant is that statement in a sense? How dependent is it on the coordinate choice that you make and the actual hyperbolic system that you use?
So it varies very much on the actual coordinate system that you use. For example, in Kerr-Shield coordinates, it just so happens that it's sort of designed in such a way where all the ingoing modes or the sort of the negative modes are traveling near the speed of light. The positive modes are going out at less than that. But that's not necessarily the case for any coordinate system. There's this sort of PG coordinate system. I don't know how to pronounce their names correctly. But in that formalism, the negative and positive characteristic modes have R varying speeds, for example, and that just has to do with your particular coordinate system. You could, in principle, do a coordinate system that doesn't have a shift, for example, like Schwarzschild's original solution or something, although that's not particularly nice to numerically evolve. So the actual characteristic speeds depend a lot on that sort of thing. But again, this is really, you can only make that statement when the background is held fixed. Once you start actually evolving space-time, then your speeds are time varying also. So all sorts of weird stuff can happen where the speed is different at the beginning of the pulse than it is at the end of the pulse or something else, for example. So a lot of the sort of seed stuff that we talked about really only matters in the weak field limit, and all sorts of weird dynamics happen in the full numerical problem.
So do you then also intend to use the weak field limit far away as sort of gauge invariant diagnostic for your system?
Yeah. So like the problem that I was showing before is sort of weak field problems. You can see like the total mass is something like 0.5% of the actual mass of the black hole. I have done some simulations with higher masses, essentially just to test stability, because that's like the very nonlinear regime. And so you expect if you're going to see instability, it's going to be somewhere in there. And I've managed to get it stable, but there's some additional subtleties that I have to deal with boundaries, where they seem to be working properly in some sense, where like all the masses change is remaining within the domain. But then once you start getting these really high amplitudes, weird things can happen at your boundaries, where depending on the gauge conditions and the particular characteristic choices you make there, the boundaries can be moving around, they can be shrinking or doing all sorts of weird things. So proper choice of boundary conditions is something I'm still working on. Sure.
Do act black hole echoes to just look like a reflecting boundary condition?
Well, so it's you might think of a physical condition like this sort of R varying scalar mass that might add that you would think would add a reflection like this. I'm essentially speculating based on the weak field limit. Essentially this is like a model for the black hole echo. So if you just imagine I have, you know, perfect reflection, what would that look like in the actual numerical relativity problem? Because a lot of people don't, I mean, I honestly have never seen anyone do like a reflecting condition like this. Although I could just not have seen it, but.
So do you want to do this for like some breakdown and then?
Okay. Well, so of course this problem is only in spherical symmetry for now, but essentially, like the idea would be you could sort of generalize this to say merger problems if you want, or you can imagine just some scalar field or anything sort of hitting a black hole and having some sort of reflective effect off of an event horizon, and you might detect that sort of thing. But this is essentially a first pass on how you might model that sort of dynamics.
Any more questions?